I was meeting with a patient regularly, and at some point she sent me a message and was like, "That's it, I can't come anymore. Goodbye." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is, you know, this is a suicidal risk. Like, did I do everything?" I think I cried for like 3 days. I called, I left so many messages. I'm like, okay, at some point I just need to stop. She luckily called like a day or two later.
I was like, "I beg your pardon. Hey, bestie, it's your favorite caffeinated, medicated, and never hydrated bestie. It's your favorite nurse, Nurse John, and welcome back to your favorite podcast. I beg your pardon, bestie. We have another week, another episode, another guest, and I am so excited to present this guest to you because I think you have been wanting this guest for a long time, even in real life. But the problem is, you can never get it because they're always full. There's not enough spaces, or we just cannot afford them. And we have been asking for them to bring them in the hospital because we need them. I mean, they're our colleagues, but they're usually in a very specific unit in the hospital. Well, before we head to that, bestie, do me a quick favor. And if you're listening to this episode, make sure that you download this episode and all other episodes of the podcast that you have not listened to on Apple and Spotify podcasts. And make sure that you follow us and turn on notifications so that you receive notification when a new episode drops every single Friday. And bestie, don't also forget to give us a 5-star review on Apple and Spotify podcasts. And bestie, if you are wondering what keeps me caffeinated other than coffee, it is Rise Fuel. R-Y-S-E-F-U-E-L, Fuel. It is one of my favorite energy drinks. I know you guys been telling me, John, look, you cannot be combining coffee and energy drinks together. But you do what you gotta do to survive your shift, right? Well, let's crack one open for myself right here. A little ASMR. Did you hear that? Look at that. A little sizzle, a little sparkle, a little like gas. Ring pop. Yeah, I love this energy drink, Rise Fuel, R-Y-S-E-F-U-E-L. And you can find them by typing in your Google search, Rise Fuel Locator, and find one the nearest to you. And bestie, if you're also wondering if I have a merch store, you can check it out at www.nursejohnnn.com, and you can sign up on our newsletter to get a discount code. All right, bestie, after all that spiel, let me introduce to you the guest for this week. Listen, bestie, this took a lot. This needed a lot of convincing to get her to sit down with us, okay? This is a whole therapy session just for you because I love you so much, so I made it happen. I brought to you a psychologist. Hello, Melissa.
Hello, John.
I am so happy that you come in here and sit down with all of us here in the podcast.
I'm very excited to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, Melissa, I think a lot of the listeners here in the podcast needs a little bit of help. I mean, like, I think we need a lot of help. Let's not minimize that. Let's be real. We need a lot of help. We would love to get to know you first before we head on to the therapy session.
Sure. So my name is Melissa Kalachi. I am a clinical psychologist and I'm currently practicing in private practice. So West Island and online.
Amazing, amazing. And how long have you been a clinical psychologist?
Since 2020. So started right at
pandemic. Wait a second. Me too. I started nursing in 2020.
Really?
Did you burn out like me?
You know what? I did.
Oh my God. Even our psychologist is burnt out. Oh my God. Look, nobody's safe. Well, we wanted to get to know you more on a deeper level. So can you tell us, were you born here in Canada?
Yeah, I was. I'm born to an Italian-Canadian family.
Are you Italian?
I am, yes.
Oh my God. I'm actually going to Italy.
I saw you got the tattoo when you went and I followed.
I love it. I love Italy. I'm actually going back this week.
Really?
Yeah, this weekend.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you're probably listening to this, but this is all backed up, you know. But I'm going to Florence. Mm. I just love Italy. There's just something about it that's just... The people are so sweet. The food is so good.
The lifestyle the lifestyle is not like it is here where everyone's burnt out, right?
Oh my God. The lifestyle there is like we live to work, not we work to live. Mm-hmm. I love that about them. Mm-hmm. And growing up, what influenced you in going to psychology? Because it is such a hard profession, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not sure I really knew what, you know, what psychologists did, or at least not as a kid, right? I really wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a pediatrician. I want to work with kids.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's such a big switch. But still, you are a doctor of your profession.
I am, yes.
And you are actually helping more people who are actually in need.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure both professions are helping quite a bit of people. But I think I definitely found my calling. I probably wouldn't have pursued even if I had decided to continue. But I think it's kind of like a cultural thing where most people are like, you become a doctor or a lawyer, right? Like that's, and I mean, my parents never pushed anything.
Right,
means,
right.
But I think I had
that. It's a cultural thing. But I was like, I'm too dumb for every other thing. So let me be a nurse. And I'm kidding. No, I actually love being a nurse. So what led you to becoming a psychologist?
I went to social science and I just started taking some psych classes. And I think I always knew I wanted some kind of helping profession. So I started taking a couple of psych classes. I really enjoyed them, took even more. And when I finished, I had one of the professors there say, have you ever thought about, you know, like an honors psychology program? I think that would be really good for you. So I looked into it. I applied. I got in and it was kind of a fluke. Like it just kind of happened that way. I wasn't really thinking about what a psychologist does or if this is going to be the profession I'm going to do for the rest of my life. But I really liked it. And then I kind of just grew from there. I grew from my bachelor's, doing some research, getting interested in certain topics. And
well, that's nice to know because usually, you know, like, for example, me, my pushing to go into nursing is the fact that my grandpa was sick and my mom has always been a caregiver. So I wanted to do something that's super close to that and also a helping profession where I can help someone else just like I helped my grandpa. And then nursing is what struck me. But it's nice to know that, you know, you can take up a profession not knowing what it is and getting into it and then growing and then realizing that, oh my God, I would never thought in a million years that I would be doing this, but I love this. So then in university, right, you went to psychology.
Yeah, I did an honors in psych. Excelled in my classes. I did well. I started some research in a sexual behavior lab, and I really started to enjoy that kind of component because grew up in a, I don't want to say really conservative family, but still, right? Like, sex is still taboo. So I started there. I started in that research lab where my supervisor was like, we can talk about, you know, sex like we talk about food. It shouldn't be taboo. And I was interested in that.
That's
kind of
true.
Framework, right?
That is so true because, you know, again, even now in these days, kids are still very scared of getting tested for STIs, protections like condoms, because they think like, oh my God, they're going to judge me in the pharmacy or like, this is so like cringe, as they say, to even tell someone that I just had like multiple sex partner. But it's completely normal.
Absolutely. And I mean, maybe it's also like it's with teens or young adults, but I see it as well with, you know, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, where it's like it's difficult to say some of the words. Like they're not going to say something's wrong with my penis, or I have like those things don't come out. It really becomes, you know, the thing down there. There's something.
Yeah, I think we're normalizing a lot of things now in this generation, and I'm so happy about it because we are talking more. We're becoming more sensitive. We're becoming more aware of things, and that we're breaking barriers. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, there's like a positive and a negative about like the Gen Z population, because I love the Gen Z population. I think they've broken so many barriers about sexual health, orientation and stuff like that. And I was like, my God, like for decades, we were just following what people from the 1940s were doing. And that's what's normal. But then we realized that we were just conforming and what the society was telling us to do. Did you have to do like a master?
No. So I did a bachelor's, and then after that I applied. It was like a fast-tracked PhD. I didn't do a master's. I went straight from my bachelor's into my PhD.
Oh my God, you are smart pants.
Actually, I applied that first year and I didn't get in. So I did take a year break. I worked as an assistant in like a in politics, really, like in the provincial.
Okay, wow.
For a year.
How was that?
It was good. I actually started there a really long time ago at like 17, and I only left second year of my PhD. So I really stayed there.
Oh my God.
Long time.
Oh my God. That's a completely different path from like psychology.
Yeah. But I have to say, it really gave me a chance to be on the field and really talk to people that were struggling with things like
right.
their Hydro-Quebec, not being able to pay for things, or struggling with just housing. Or so it really allowed me to talk to people that were really struggling.
Right.
And I think it also made it a little clear for me, too, that I really wanted to go into psych and be able to help.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And like growing up, were your parents like, were they like very empathetic? What kind of like values did you grow up with that kinds of align as a psychologist?
Well, I mean, I think putting other people's interests or needs first, I'm not saying it's always great, right? Maybe it's a little bit toxic there too, but
it's
something
that's what we usually do for the healthcare workers. So what would we do anyways? That's why we burn out. But yeah.
But I think we were raised a little bit like that of, you know, just don't let it bother you. Keep going. Help people when you can. And I got to see my mom do that a lot. My mom's super selfless. Like, she'll do everything for mm-hmm. everyone, right? She's going to mm-hmm. put everyone before herself. And I guess those are kind of the models I had,
right.
at least from women growing up. And
right.
So I kind of...
That's amazing. That's amazing. So when you graduated your PhD degree, where did you start working?
So I was working in the hospital setting for Ooh. An internship right before I graduated. And I also was working a little bit in a clinic, in a private practice clinic,
okay.
Part-time. And so when I graduated, I continued in the private practice, but I really loved the hospital setting. So I applied and I started working there as well.
Me too. I could never work in any other places but the hospital. I mean, it's chaotic. There's a lot of things happening. It's overstimulating. But I feel like... that's where I find like the joy of working as a healthcare worker. You know what I mean?
I definitely do. There's nothing quite like a hospital, at least like an inpatient setting. There's just something really special about the teams, but the patients as well, the cases you get to collaborate on. It'll always hold a very special place for me.
Yeah. So you work in the hospital setting for how long?
I worked in the hospital maybe a little over a year.
A little over a year. And in a psychiatric unit?
Yep. And as well, a little bit of an outpatient unit that I was helping out that was short-staffed at the time.
Short-staffed. Well, she just mentioned what we're all waiting for, short-staffed.
Or understaffed.
Yeah. Do psychologists get short-staffed too?
In the public system, it's tough.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's hard to find one. And if there's one... they're pretty much occupied.
There's usually, a long waiting list, which is unfortunate because people who really need access to one tend to have to wait a little longer than
they go in private. I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have here in the Western is that a lot of us just have mental health illness going on, undiagnosed and diagnosed. And it's such a big problem that we have to deal with. And that's why I think psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists so much is because, my God, without you guys, I don't know what I'm going to do because I have my own therapist. And during the times when I burnt out and I was feeling so helpless and unheard and, you know, unloved by all of the things that I love about being a nurse, she helped me get through it. Like, it was such a tough time. And I think a lot of healthcare workers are going through it. And even the psychologists. Do psychologists need psychologists too?
I mean, I would assume so. I do. I have a therapist.
Thank you. See, you guys, even our therapist has a therapist. And that's completely normal. People don't realize how, like, we all have, in some certain, like, status in our life, have things that we cannot deal with ourselves, even though we have the tool to deal with it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We just need someone from outside of our family, friends, and colleagues to tell us the simplest thing that you could have done yourself, but you just need that someone to tell you to do it.
Even if you know what you have to do, like, you just need that little push sometimes of someone to tell you, like, come on, get real and just apply that. Like, you know this. And I'm like, I know it. But I think it's important. We're human too, right? Like,
exactly.
We present a certain way for work. And I think that's in every profession. You kind of show up a little bit differently when you're in that context. But
exactly.
Overall, I have my own, you know, family issues. I have my own relationship issues. I have, like, those things don't go away just because we help other people, especially when you're so close to your own problem.
That's it. And I think, like, people also have to realize that, you know, oh my God, so why do I go to my psychologist if she's also mentally ill? Because that's completely fine. Just like your nurses are depressed, your nurses have PTSD, trauma, ADHD, whatever that is, what kind of mental illness is it? That doesn't stop us from performing and doing our job as a healthcare worker. We can do our job, but we also need help.
And I was going to say, it likely makes you that much more real and authentic. Like, being able to have your own struggles and call them out or just kind of recognize them makes you feel human too, right?
It's like,
I'm not perfect. And I don't want to be seen as perfect either. I want to be seen as relatable. Of, you know what? That thing that happened, well, you know what? It happened to me too. Now, how much I'm going to disclose might differ from, you know, having a conversation with a friend, but...
But that's so true, because like when my therapist tells me like I was on that position too, it makes me feel better. It makes me feel like reassured that, okay, I'm not the only one going through it. And even the person that I'm asking for help have been through it or is going through it. And now I feel so much better that, you know, we can trauma bond. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an important thing. So you work in the hospital setting. And during that, you work in the psychiatry department. And what is it like in a day of a psychologist in a psychiatric department?
What's really exciting about it is that it changes every single day. And I think I don't have that anymore. I'm no longer in a hospital setting. But definitely when I was, the exciting part is you come in, you don't know what to really expect that day, and you really get to work with a group of amazing people. Like,
right.
I am never going to forget that experience for the people that you meet, the different points of views that you get from collaborating on a multidisciplinary team. That's
right.
Gold.
And you work hand in hand with the nurses, right?
Yeah, with the nurses, with OT, with psychiatrists, with nurse practitioners. Like,
that's really amazing. And your job in the multidisciplinary team is what exactly?
I would meet with patients when they would come in, start some kind of assessment, and then we collaborate on diagnosis and treatments. But mostly it's making the patients feel heard and understood, helping with some coping strategies, some psychoeducation on what their diagnosis is, meeting with families sometimes, helping them really understand the patient, helping or gaining collateral from family members to help better understand and treat the patient. So right. That would be a big part of my role.
And whenever you get a new patient, like, how do you assess them without knowing anything about them? Do you assess them based off the basic knowledge that you got from a report?
I wouldn't make a diagnosis based on just the information that was available. And even at that, it would be more kind of ruling out diagnosis. We would work through that with the psychiatrist and with the team. But I would sit with them. I would sit with them for a good hour if they were able to tolerate it. And we would talk about their life. And we were trying to really build a rapport, a relationship. Tell me about what's been going on the last little bit. You know, what are the struggles? What's your support system like? You know, what's going good in your life? What are your hobbies? What do you really enjoy doing? Like, I think it's really scary, especially when patients come into the hospital. They don't know really what's going on. And as much as the psych ward is, you know, it's meant to really be a place to help create, you know, some kind of containment for people who are really struggling, it can be really scary sometimes. And there's a lot of things that they, you know, they're not used to, and people they're not used to, and checks. And, you know, so it's helpful to just feel heard and have some time to just talk about what your experience is like. And so a lot of that would be sitting down and listening to be able to gather information that I can then share with the team. And that they would have as well, different points of views from their interactions with that patient. So it wouldn't be strictly based on some kind of report. It really is sitting down and really getting an evaluation with what's your life like? What are your struggles? What are your symptoms? And evaluating with the patient
right.
present.
Right, exactly. And I remember when I used to be in psych, because I was in psych too, and actually psych is one of my favorite specialty in nursing, just because it really did interest me when I was doing my clinicals, my rotation in psych, how interesting the mind works and how childhood and the things that you grew up with, your environment, your nature and nurture affects all of the things that you have right now in your life. And it's just, it's shocking too, because you read this super heavy past life and medical history and you're like, oh my God, how can someone go through so much and, you know, expect them to be completely sane after this? Mm-hmm. Like, it's impossible.
Definitely put sometimes in perspective, like our own challenges, right? Like right. We really get a chance to, and I think, honestly, as a psychologist, I feel super privileged to have access to people's lives that people, you know, trust sharing their pasts and their struggles with me, because it's not something that's very, you know, easy to open up about. So to be that person who can kind of hold space for that, I think is extreme, not just rewarding for me, but really, I really do feel privileged to have access to that information.
Right, right. Like you say, you don't just share your deepest, darkest secrets or like, you know, things that you would just want to keep to yourself until you freaking die. But then, you know, some people are so, they need it to be so vulnerable so that they can actually get the help they need. It's such a special moment for us two nurses, because I have had patients who opens up to me about things. I was like, oh my God, like, thank you for telling me this. Mm-hmm. Like, I promise you with all my heart that I would keep this between both of us. But thank you for trusting me with that information, because that probably felt so much better to yourself that you're able to tell it to someone, because you've been keeping it for like, I don't know, in 20 years. And now you're ready to open up to someone who's a stranger, complete stranger, and you just made a connection with them. And now all of a sudden you're like, well, I will trust this person about that. We are in such a crazy, I think, profession that, you know, I don't know how we take the traumas. Because it's hard. I'm pretty sure it's hard for you to hear all of these things. And the hardest is hearing things that you relate to so much. And you're just like, man, what the fuck? You're probably like, that's me.
You know, it has happened sometimes where you're kind of in a session with someone and you're like, oh my God, like, I'm saying the things that I need to hear. Right? You're like, is this therapy for me or for this? I try and be as conscious as possible to, right, you know, to right. recognize, because I'm obviously going to have my own biases, right?
Yeah, yeah.
From, you know, from what's going on in my life, depending on where we're at. So it is challenging. And I think part of that is having my own therapy and supervision, like really being able to hash out some of the cases that are a little bit more difficult for me, especially now that I'm in private practice, because at least in a hospital setting, you get to do that. You have that team that you can kind of hash out those things with. In private practice, I really look forward to meeting with my supervisor to kind of go through some of those things together and just allow me to place of, you know, what belongs to me and really what belongs to my clients or my patients, so that I can really make that distinction and keep that
right. And it's really hard sometimes.
It is.
For me, it's like not taking home the things that I've just seen, heard, and listened. Like, sometimes I take it home because it's so hard and it's so heavy and I'm just like, why am I carrying this with me?
I think the fact that you carry it with you is kind of an indication that you're good at what you do, right? Because you're kind of putting your heart into the people that you meet and the patients that right. you treat. So I think if you were completely disconnected, we'd have a different issue at hand, right?
Right, right. But, you know, there are people who can really disconnect themselves from, like, you know, after the job, you're not even going to ask me no question and I don't even know what to answer to it. But I think my problem is that I tend to care a lot more than others. And I think that's like one of my problems as a human being, is that I tend to care more a lot about others. I don't know. Maybe growing up, that's how I was raised. But like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have very similar, you know, dynamics there.
Not as not as bonding on the same.
No, but I mean, I think that's part of, you know, the work that's challenging, is really trying to leave work at work. And it's not always possible, but this is where I really, you know, I I really enjoy having my friends, having family, having, you know, someone to go home to that allows me to disconnect, to talk to other people, to do things that I enjoy.
Right.
So that it's not all about work, because when your whole identity is your profession, I think that's where you're really at risk, where you, there's no, you know, it's almost like all the eggs in the same basket. If that's, you know, only based on work, when work's not going too well, well, your kind of life is falling apart in other aspects too, because there's nothing to kind of protect or create a barrier for it.
Did you guys listen to that? That's coming from a psychologist. You're not always a nurse. You're only a nurse when you're in a hospital, but you can disconnect from being that nurse from the hospital. Yes, I think because I'm saying that because a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my besties cannot really disconnect themselves from like being a nurse. And like I said, I am guilty of that too myself, that it happens so many times that I'm still working even outside the hospital. It's not like I do it consciously, it's unconscious. And it's because I probably the fact that I've been working way too much that I'm just like, okay, well, I see my colleagues more than my family and friends. So,
but I think that's where you need to kind of be self-aware and catch it. Because if it's been a little while where you're seeing your colleagues way more than your family and your friends, mm-hmm. that's the little alarm sign, or the little alarm signal, I guess, right? At some point that tells you, hey, I need to take that step back. I need the vacation. I need the weekend away or whatever it is, a night out for the
that's
friends.
That's it. And the thing is, like, we have a really bad coping mechanism as nurses, and I am guilty.
Okay.
My bad coping mechanisms are red wine, McDonald's. Because I was like, you know what? I had a hard day. Let me get myself some 20 pieces chicken nuggets, one large McFlurry, and a triple patty cheeseburger, extra cheese. Because I don't know. We tend to numb the pain. I don't know what's that. Like, why do we resort to that?
Oh, I don't know if I have an answer for why you resort to that. But maybe it's like you're saying, it's in a way to numb or to kind of disconnect from everything at the end of the day. And there's, I mean, food is pleasurable. No one's, you know, no one's binging on baby carrots, right? Like the food that you end up eating or the things are enjoyable things that allow you to kind of disconnect. Now, McDonald's or a glass of wine once in a while, it's not necessarily a problem if you can manage that. But it's more when it becomes a maladaptive behavior where really like you can't live your life outside of those things or it's really a necessity at the end of your day. Maybe it's worth looking at, well, what other ways allow me to kind of unwind, feel pleasure, enjoy my evenings when I'm done my job, right?
Right, right. Well, going back to the conversation of you working in the hospital, you said you work in the hospital for a year. What made you switch to clinical private practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened is what happens to a lot of people in the public system.
I'll therapy you this time. Tell me what happened.
I mean, I honestly really love the people I worked with and I really love the patients. So I have nothing, I have nothing bad to say about the hospital setting per se. It was just, it does get taxing. And I was juggling both the hospital and private practice at the same time. So I was doing like getting in at 7:30 in the morning, leaving at 4:30, driving to private practice and then working till 9, getting home at like 9:30, 10, only to restart that the next, like,
yeah,
they were really long days.
Right.
And I think it's where I cued in of it's not sustainable long term. Like I wasn't going to be able to do that. And I started to do less of what I really loved in the hospital and a little bit more of work in a different department that really needed extra hands. So
okay,
I wasn't,
so you
really
were kind of like floated on places that you're not really interested
in. A little bit. And I mean, I understood the need. There's definitely a need, and obviously I want to help. But at some point, the reason why you joined, you know,
a certain
particular unit or department, yeah, was because you really, you know, that's what you were passionate about. That's the team you really want to work with. And when I started to get further and further away from that, and I was really struggling with a little bit of burnout too. I was overwhelmed, overworked. I think I hit the ground running, right? I finished my studies and I'm like, okay, we're in
a pandemic. That's literally me. That's literally me.
Just take in the moment. You just finished a huge chapter of your life. Like, just take it in before you start the next one. And I think I definitely didn't do that.
Me too.
I wish, you know, I would have done that at the beginning of my career, but here we are now. I mean, I don't regret it.
Right. Same.
It was an experience. It was really, I think I needed to be pushed to that limit to realize that that wasn't something I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. It's just we needed to learn it the hard way.
Yeah.
So you burn out, but did you saw the signs of burnout or were you also blind like I was to it? Because I did not see it until it was worse.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a mix. I think I saw it, but I didn't necessarily frame it as burnout or working too hard. I really loved what I did. Like,
oh,
I
for
would
sure.
be excited to come into work. Like, I would be excited to leave late, like, because I had nothing better to do at home. I would, like,
me too. Like, oh, my God.
Sometimes there, it's like 8 o'clock, and I'm like at night, right? You're like, I should be done. I'm done at, like, 4, 4:30. Like, what am I doing here? But I'm just... I don't know.
You're
I
enjoying
loved
it.
The adrenaline that comes with,
right,
being,
right.
with being on the unit. So I think part of it I kind of did to myself, right? Because I pushed myself further than maybe setting clear boundaries for myself and respecting that. But I definitely felt it at towards the end. I'd say the last like month or two, I really started to feel that it wasn't a pace, like I said, that was sustainable for me. I was really struggling to just do good work. Like I started to get a little less motivated. I mean, I still did the work I had to
of
do.
Of course, of course, of course. Like we,
but
like
the enthusiasm,
I did.
Right?
Yeah, the enthusiasm is not the same. So then you moved on to private practice.
Yep.
Finally, completely.
Well, not right away, actually. I still stayed in at the clinic that I was working at. So
okay.
I left the hospital.
Yeah.
I left the hospital. And at that point, I decided I kind of wanted something for myself. I want to figure out, you know, how I love to work. I want to eventually build a team. I want to start a clinic.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah.
So you have your own practice now.
Yes. Now I have my own practice as of July. So it's about half a year.
That's amazing. And what do you do now?
So now I work mostly with relationship and sexual issues. So that's my area right now.
Everyone, if you're listening to this and you need a psychologist, do you have slots?
Very, very, very limited. But I'm looking to build a team. So hopefully soon.
To anyone, later in this episode, we will tell you where to find Melissa here in Montreal. And you can sign up. Because you all need some relationship advice. We all do, I feel like. And it's something that we have to deal with as nurses too. Because it's so taxing to, you know, coming home. And let's say your partner is not in the same profession as you. And they don't really understand what you're going through. Do you have any of those cases?
If I have cases, I mean, I live that life.
Oh,
mean,
my God. It's true. Okay.
My partner is not in my field at all. My partner is in restaurant, right? And I'm,
okay. And have you ever been a therapist for your partner?
I mean, I really try not to. It's not, and it's really difficult to do because, again, you're biased, right?
You're
in that relationship. It's not, you don't. So I really don't.
You know, I was just thinking in my head. I was like, have you ever been like, oh my God, you are depressed, man. Or like, you have anger problems, boy.
I mean, we all do at some point. Like, I don't think it's a diagnosis to have an anger problem once in a while or to express anger, right? But yeah, no, I don't. I really try not to impose
Good.
That.
And that's boundaries, right? That's boundaries you set for work, for relationship, and just...
For myself and for my partner too. Like I wouldn't want to say like, oh, you're in psychologist mode right now. Like it's not fair either to be in that dynamic at home.
Right. I mean, like a lot of nurses could relate to this because, you know, I know that your husband, who's probably a blue collar job, is like, oh, you're acting like a nurse right now. And it's hard because a lot of nurses come home, you know, to a home and they just want peace. It's a running inside joke to us nurses though, that we come home and we don't even want to be spoken to. We just need that peace and quiet because we're so overstimulated at work and there's so much things happening that, you know, when you get home, you just want to be peace and quiet. And then you come back when you're ready type of thing.
I mean, I can see that happening maybe when I was more at the hospital and, you know, having kind of the buzz all day long, right? Like there's something happening all day long. Now that I make my own schedule and I work from home most of the time.
Oh my God.
So yeah, that's definitely a privilege. I'm not
Do you feel happier that you went private practice?
There's pros and cons to that as well. I think that there's like a loneliness aspect that comes with working by yourself. Like the only people I really speak to in a day are my clients and my partner at the end of the day. Like,
So I don't really miss that colleague, that multidisciplinary kind of like,
yeah, you miss, you know, team. That doorway kind of chat that lasts, you know, a couple minutes and, you know, has nothing to do necessarily with, with work.
So like going back to your now private practice of you handling like relationship and more sexuality. So what kind of like relationship problems do you usually deal with? Like what's the most common problem?
Ooh, I don't know if there's a most common, but typically, I'm looking at infidelity. I'm looking at loss of love or intimacy in a relationship.
Right.
I'm looking at changes that happen in the relationship after becoming parents. So kind of finding yourselves again when that happens. Mm-hmm.
That's really hard. Because let me start with this. Mm-hmm. Let me bring you some problems and you tell me how you're going to deal with it. Because I feel like my besties are going to need this. I know I'm being an advocate for all of you besties, okay? I'm doing it for all of you. So one thing some nurses do deal with is infidelity. Mm-hmm. It happens a lot in a hospital setting. Okay. Just because, let's say we have our own partner at home and whatnot. And we see people at work who relates to us and who bonds with us to trauma. And then, you know, cheating and all that stuff happens and nobody knows. And I know Grey's Anatomy is not all scripted. Some of those things really do happen in real life. And I have seen it and I have heard it. And why do you think this thing happens in the hospital? Like,
I mean, I guess that's tough. I mean, I think in part it's probably because they are bonding and kind of relating on a level that maybe they don't have the ability or they're not really relating that way with their partner. I think as well, when you're in a relationship, especially for a long-term relationship, at some point it takes work. It's not novel and spontaneous. And then what you get with that new person that you're living these really exhilarating moments with, even if they are anxiety-provoked moments. But you're living high emotional states with someone else, it might make them seem a little bit more desirable than the kind of stable, responsible partner that's waiting for you at home. And so maybe it makes it a little bit more likely that you're going to do something.
It gives a little bit more spicy to the to your life.
You feel alive a little bit when you're struggling or when things are kind of neutral or kind of,
Right. And what do you suggest to these people who's kind of like in that kind of like situation? Like, what would you tell them if they're struggling and like, should they be open to their partners and telling them about that situation or how should they stop themselves from doing it?
Yeah, I think if you can recognize it, that'd be really great. It's a great start, right? Of realizing, hey, I have desire. I'm interested in somebody else. And then is it really that person that you're interested in? Or is it something that's not going so great in your relationship or at home? And if it's that, then it's worth bringing that back into the relationship. I think, you know, having desire for someone else is not really a problem. It's what you do with that. Because you can fuel that desire with, you know, with other people. We're not blind, even though we're in relationships.
Right.
So we can look, but then we can take that back and fuel the relationship that we have.
And what would you suggest to healthcare workers who are struggling on connecting in a deeper level with their partners at home because they're in a completely different job and they feel like they're not understood by their partner, their needs, their wants, their concerns are just not, you know, I think that's a lot of what nurses deal with is that you come home wishing that you are being treated like how you treat your patient, but you know, the people that you love, and then you come home and you're still have to be a nurse because, you know, some people come home and they're still a mom, mm-hmm. you know, they're still a wife, they're still a this, they're still a that. And it's like, they feel like it's a never ending thing that they just don't have, you know, that support, that love for them.
And it might not even be that they don't have the support or the love, but it might be we have a certain expectation of what we want our partner or the people that we love, you know, to do for us. But unless we really communicate that, we're at risk that they're not going to be able to provide that, right? Like maybe our partner is making dinner, but if, you know, it's not dinner that we need, it's that they, you know, did the groceries or that they tidied up the house and they didn't do those things, then we kind of miss some of the things that our partners can do if we're not really clear on what it is that we want. And I think communication is a struggle for a lot of couples. Like beyond the dynamics that you're bringing up. So having a good foundation of how do we talk about these things so that we can both feel understood, I think that's really important to start at that base, right? Not and, just when we have the problems.
Right. And how do you become more communicative when you feel like there's this sense of like, I don't know if I should tell this to my partner, or I don't think she or he would even understand. So why tell them?
But if we're starting from that point of view, right, of I don't think they're going to understand, then we're not really going to be able to, or it's going to limit how we, or impact at least, right, how we present what it is that we want to get across. So I think having a framework or just being aware of what we do want to share, and then telling the other person, look, it's not easy for me to bring this thing up, but it's something that I do want to talk to you about because you're important to me and what I have to say is important. So can we find the time? You know, if it doesn't work, there's always therapy, right? You can always sign up and go for some couples therapy and have someone intervene and help you find ways that are built on communication skills. But it's just a great place to say, hey, I need to be heard. And, you know, can we make some time for that? Because I feel like I'm struggling. I'm working long hours. I'm coming home. I'm tired. And I feel like it just never ends. So can we just, you know, take the pulse a little bit on what's going on in our relationship and how we can maybe make something a little bit better?
I love that. Oh my God. Listen, Mel, I think a lot of my nursing besties are crying right now. Are you guys wiping your tears? They're relating to this because this is such a struggle with a lot of us, is that, you know, we have relationship that we have to upkeep, plus the job that's like, again, you understand it because you've been in that position, and it's really hard to be working in the hospital at this moment and nobody understand that. None but those people that you work with. And it's just hard to not be able, and not a lot of people can afford therapy or a psychologist, or they have been on the waiting list for so long and their mental health is just getting worse and worse every day. And, you know, it's such a problem because it's not prioritized. For example, in a hospital, we have this poster of like, if you need help, if you need someone to talk to, call 1-877. And that line is not even available. And like, it's not even the most helpful thing.
Yeah, I think there's a problem with accessibility right now. But I mean, it doesn't even have to be therapy if you can't start there, right? Like just surrounding yourself, like building your social network is going to be helpful. Prioritizing yourself. How many times do we make, you know, a doctor's appointment and actually show up for it because we're going to let someone else down if we don't show up? But how many times do we set up, you know, I'm going to go for a yoga class the next week, and then you just, you know, I'm tired that day. I'm just going to not go, or I'm going to just let that, you know, not be a priority. If we set those things for ourselves and we follow through, we're really being able to build that kind of lifestyle that allows us to have some kind of protective barrier to the burnout and the stressors that we have.
So, like a routine too, setting our routine.
A routine, or just prioritizing really your time. So often, especially in healthcare professions, is we prioritize helping other people, sometimes to our detriment, right? Like we don't focus on ourselves nearly enough. So it's very easy to say, okay, I just won't do that. Or you know what, I'll do that next week. Or when it comes to things that are important for us, meanwhile, we very rarely, you know, push those things aside for other people. We don't want to let other people down.
That's it. Because I think one of our biggest problems as healthcare worker, mostly for nurses, is we have such a people-pleasing personality.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to generalize for everyone, but part of it is, you know, recognizing that you matter, right? Like that it's important for us to put ourselves first. A little bit, we hear it all the time, right? You can't pour from an empty kettle or, right?
Yeah, like an empty cup and whatnot.
Yeah, so ideally, we want to be able to invest in ourselves. But again, like you're saying, a lot of us put other people first and we're not really investing in ourselves. So it really becomes being able to recognize we're enough. We're, you know, we're important too. And we need to set some limits and some boundaries for what, you know, what can be crossed and what definitely can't. So if it is, you know, I need that afternoon for myself, or I need a day of a weekend, or whatever it is, but that we actually follow through on that. I think it's really important that we focus on ourselves, at least dedicate a certain amount of time or energy for us before we expect, or we give, and then we expect, because I think that's a big problem too, is that we give and we have this kind of notion. It's almost like a culture where if I give so much, then I expect the other person to treat me the same way I treat them. And when they don't, it builds resentment because we're frustrated that we do so much. Well, why couldn't they, you know, just see that I needed this or just do this for me because I would have done it?
So would you say that we should lower our expectations?
I don't know if lowering them would be the solution to it, but at least kind of set some clear boundaries for, are we doing it because we really want to, or are we doing it because we feel obligated or we want to be liked, or, you know, it's a nice thing to do.
Right, right. Oh my God, my besties. This is a lot of therapy you're getting.
You're not getting therapy. We
love therapy. You know what? I have been suggesting, and I have been thinking in my head, I came up with this. I was like, why don't they bring like a psychologist on the floor in every single unit, if possible, and every single week we get to sit down with a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or a therapist and kind of unload it there, right in the hospital, so we don't take it home. Mm-hmm. And I think a psychologist would love to be there too, because that's what they do best, right? And I feel like, you know, having that resource instead of a pizza party or a freaking pen and a raisin oatmeal as a gift for us, we would appreciate it better. And I think it would keep nurses better in a hospital, and PAB, CNAs, LPNs, social workers in their job. I don't know if you're listening to the news, but like in like 2030, there's not going to be half of the nurses in, or even healthcare workers in the hospital, because they're leaving the profession. Some people are like going to, yeah, I'll work in freaking McDonald's. At least I'm not like responsible for like this much lives in my hands, and I'm probably happier in that. It's crazy. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. We're in a really hard state. Yeah. Anyways, moving forward, there's a few questions that people from social media wanted to ask you. Are you ready for the hot seat?
Yes, let's go for it.
Let's get cracking. Okay, let's do this. First question, what's the most challenging part of your job as a psychologist?
It's always challenging to kind of be there and kind of put your things aside, be present for your clients. But on a general level, I would say probably when you're dealing with people who have suicidal ideations or something that's kind of active in the moment, where it's sometimes hard to tolerate when you end a session, despite the resources and the strategies that you provide, the work you do in the session, there's always this little risk. There's always this kind of little thing that you have in the back of your head. What if something happens? What if I didn't do something right? What if, I think that fear that kind of sticks with you between sessions with clients that are a little bit more vulnerable, for me, it was challenging.
Right. I completely understand that, because I have had that situation. Did I do what I should have done? Did I fuck it up? Am I going to be the reason why this person is going to do what they're going to do? You know what I mean? Like, it's hard. It's such a hard situation to be at. Oh my God. Next question. What do you suggest for nurses who deals with death and traumatic experiences almost every day?
I mean, I definitely, again, have a lot of respect for people who work in a department or in a unit where there's that level of trauma. Like, that part of, as well, of the reasons why I kind of stick to now couples and sexuality. If I come back to what we were talking about before, of really building your social network, really having support so that when you do leave that environment from work, you have something to disconnect to. You get a chance to laugh. You get a chance to kind of just be you, because it definitely can get heavy when you're constantly seeing trauma, and have a therapist. I think, you know, whether, you know, you want to do that with a professional, whether you kind of want to take time to work on yourself, but really being self-aware, being able to reflect and being able to kind of distinguish or differentiate between work and your personal life. Otherwise, it's going to be very consuming. It's going to be really difficult.
Taxing. Yeah, that's crazy. Good. Next question. What's the most common mental illness have you treat or been involved with?
I think the most common out there is kind of like the cold and flu for psychologists, is depression and anxiety. Like, that's where you kind of see it everywhere.
What's the scariest experience you've ever had as a psychologist? Scariest experience. Oh my God, that's a little deep.
I think something that maybe marked me the most was, I was meeting with a patient regularly, and at some point she sent me a message and was like, "That's it, I can't come anymore. Goodbye." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is, you know, this is a suicidal risk. Like, did I do everything? I think I cried for like 3 days. I called. I left so many messages. I'm like, okay, at some point, God, I just need to stop. She luckily called like a day or two later. God. And was like, good. Oh no, I was just going to go to my sister's for a bit and I couldn't come to the next appointments. But the way it was framed, I was convinced. I'm like, this is her farewell. And I really panicked. Like, I think that was likely one of the
It must be really
ones.
Hard. Yeah. Oh my God. That's yeah, that is scary. That is very scary.
Yeah.
Next, how is dating as a psychologist? And do you see right through the bullshit? I think we talk about it a bit, but like, yeah. Have you ever like went on a date before? I don't know if you've been with your partner for a long time, even before you were a psychologist, but like, have you ever went to a date and you're kind of like, yeah, that's a narcissistic man. I'm not going.
I think, I've been with my partner 2 years. So I was dating before, like while studying psychology and the beginning of
my
career.
Tell us.
To a certain extent, you kind of take look at people. A little bit, right? But I mean, I don't know if I'm doing it from a clinical perspective. Like, I think we're just kind of taking a look at, I don't think that's going to really work. Or I think this person is, you know, has a character that's just not going to fit with mine. But yeah, I don't think I'm like analyzing them.
Because nurses do that. We will be in public and be like, yeah, that patient has cardiac issues. You know what I mean? Like, we're diagnosing people in the public type of thing. Oh my God.
I don't think I've really done that. Not just like in dating in general. I try not to kind of, I think it takes more than just face value to analyze someone. Yeah. So I just don't have the time or energy to do that.
Next question. Have you ever misdiagnosed a patient before?
Ooh, I mean, not purposefully. Like,
imagine perfect. Next question. What are some methods of helping yourself to stop self-harming?
I think part of that is trying to understand why you're self-harming. Like, is it I'm feeling misunderstood? Is it loneliness? Is it an overflow of emotional pain that we're turning into physical pain? I mean, it's helpful to get help. Like, at that point, I think it's helpful to, whether it's talking to someone.
Right. And I think I'm giving my perspective here as a nurse is that if you're in a stage where you feel like harming yourself, I think it's good to recognize that you can always ask for help. There are numbers out there you can call. There's 811. You can go to the hospital and get help, because you have to realize that you are not alone facing any battles in your life, and that it is not a weakness to ask for help. Asking for help is actually a sign of strength, because you're able to recognize what's wrong. You're able to recognize that I am not able or capable of helping my own self or doing this alone. So I am asking someone else to come help me because it's necessary. And I think, you know, before it's too late, before things are worsened. And again, I cannot speak for everybody or anybody because I have never been on that shoe. But as a healthcare worker and have seen things and have experienced things and also going through, you know, my own mental illness and stuff, it's really like being aware and being able to tell yourself that I am having a shitty day. I am not feeling well. I am depressed. I am anxious. Really being honest to yourself that there is something wrong, and it's totally and completely fine that you're not feeling okay, because you are not the only one. Many of us are not feeling okay, but recognizing it, taking it in, being honest to yourself is such an important part of it. And I think that's the biggest help you can ever give yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have said it any better. Right? Seek help. It is a strength.
And you're not alone.
You don't have to be alone.
That's it. And then that's coming from a mentally ill nurse, I'm telling you. Lastly, what is something you want future psychologists or people who have interest in mental health and helping others just like you to know?
Go for it, definitely, if it's something that interests you. I think there's such a big range of opportunities within the field that it does require a little bit of searching, right? Like I was saying, the hospital setting is very, or inpatient psych is very different from just being in a clinic as well, of kind of doing a lot of the depression, anxiety, to now being a little bit more specific in couples and sexuality. So you get to get a sense of what it is that you like, and that there are so many people and so many ways to help, that if it's something that interests you, you'll find something that you'll really enjoy. And it's a really rewarding, work.
So, amazing.
But I maybe what we spoke about before, of when you finish, take the break and really take some time to kind of let it set in and have great boundaries, or at least try to set up some great boundaries so that you can make that distinction between personal life and work life.
Amazing. Mel, we could talk about this for a whole time. Listen, guys, this is not a real therapy session, but we all felt a sense of, you know, she made us feel heard. We feel now that even psychologists like Melissa are also human beings who are going through things, and she is just like every single one of us. And that you have to realize that you're not the only one going through things. And with the right support system, with the right setting and upholding boundaries, with the right self-love and self-care, you can too. Even with mental illness, family problems, relationship problems, can keep going in your life. And it's not the end of it. And again, that asking for help, even in what profession you're in, you can be a doctor, architect, or whatever profession you're in, or whatever you're doing, is that asking for help is not a weakness. It is a sign of strength, because you are able to recognize what is wrong, what you need help with, and that you are just another human being, just like everybody else in this earth. Thank you again so much, Melissa, for being here, for listening to us, for sharing your point of view as a psychologist, because I think people needs to know that, you know, even psychologists are also human being, that you guys are not perfect, that you guys are equal, just like every single one of us in the world.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. I'm really glad that I got to share a little bit of my experience and just share with you today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Bessie, if you, again, listening to this, make sure that you download this episode and all the other episodes that you have not listened to on Apple and Spotify podcasts. Make sure that you leave us a 5-star review, and also follow us and turn on notifications so that you receive a notification every time a new episode comes out every single Friday. And again, Bessie, if you want to come see my merch, just type www.nursejohnnn.com and sign up on the newsletter so you get a discount code. And again, I will see you guys again for another week next week with another episode of your favorite therapy podcast. I beg your pardon. I will see you guys again. Goodbye. Bye. Amazing. Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it.